Dorian. I'm waiting online here, hovering.
Well, Dennis, I just joined the two calls.
Dorian has produced three separate products that he makes, and he's offering them as prizes for the three prize-winning winners of today, which is woohoo! Yaha! And so we will do that later in the call because what happens is Barry has got this extraordinary number generator that he uses to make that happen, and we'll just do that later in the call. So without any further ado, what I'd like to do is welcome Dorian today, not yesterday or tomorrow, but today, to the call. Now, Dorian, why don't you start with a little bit of how you got involved in this whole area of Ormus. How did you get involved in the whole Ormus thing in the first place?
Well, I ran into Dave Hudson stuff online. I do a lot of research, and actually about 12 years ago, I kind of dropped the work I was doing, and I've had a fairly long career in the world of art, both as an illustrator, designer, and in the graphics, and finally in the motion graphics and video. But I had all these backgrounds, and we were trying to find work in L.A., and I was teaching illustration and graphics, and we decided that we really should try doing our own show, my partner and I, and then I got married, and my wife and my partner and I sat down and came up with a plan to produce a science show that we thought the world needed. We were going to do a show on comet disasters.
You were going to do a show on which?
We were going to do a show on comet disaster and neocatastrophism, one of the things I'd studied. My background was originally in the sciences, and very disheartened in school because I realized that science, as it exists today, is basically controlled by funding and by peer review, which is really peer pressure. I mean, you kowtow or you don't make it. And I was an interdisciplinary scientist, I think, day one. I grew up on Cousteau's work in underwater archaeology and biology, and I loved biology. Went into school for that and ended up deciding that rather than pithing frogs, I'd paint them. And I became an illustrator. And then I began teaching, and I just kind of kept moving in that direction. But in the 80s, early 80s, I ran into a man, a man named Charles Waltman, who became my mentor, more or less, over a period of about 17 years. And this is required. You have to understand where this comes from, because I couldn't be where I'm at today without a knowledge of the ether. This was something dismissed by many scientists today, but I can tell you from experience and from work in alchemy as well, the ether is a very real thing, not what ancient scientists may have thought it was, but it's very real. You know, people call it zero-point energy. We've got lots of names. But anyway, yeah. I got involved in the sciences, drifted out of them, and got back involved. And I was asked to illustrate basically a cosmological theory. And over 17 years, as I was trained and was exposed directly to gravitational field technology, this is etheric technology that our governments have that we don't know about, that's often called alien. I won't go into the cover-up story, but basically I got involved in this. And one thing led to another. And over the years, I ended up getting involved in this show. I wanted to do a show on comet disaster. I was concerned about the repeat cyclic nature of comet disasters and that we'd see another one. And as I began to do this show, funding ran out, and we were stuck with a lot of great interviews, a lot of insights into migration patterns and basically history, starting and stopping, or the many historical records ending with various catastrophes. And in fact, some leading theorists in Europe were responsible for what we call coherent catastrophism, which was a model that allowed us to understand that a number of these events within historic time, we were saying going back from about 4200, the flood of Noah, quote-unquote, or whatever flood that is, up through 3114 B.C., about 2300 B.C., then again in 1637, and once again some smaller events in 1265, about 935, and about 615, as well as the fall of the Roman Empire in 540, were all linked to one sort or another of cosmic debris, rocks, sometimes gas, and dust clouds, different things that had caused the problems. And so as I was researching the show, we said, well, can we warn people? Can we get enough information out that NASA, you know, will be asked questions they won't really answer? Now, we call NASA in our business Never a Straight Answer. That's the acronym for them. And anyway, we were going to publish this. Then the show kind of fell apart. I said, well, I'm going to go ahead and fund this anyway. So I was out there doing research now, not only in comet disaster theory, but also in migration patterns. And this got to the point where I was looking at the Internet, looking around for information on migration patterns, and ran into some interesting anomalies in Colorado and other parts of the country. Now, anybody who might be familiar with Barry Fell, who was a diffusionist, not living anymore, but one of the great diffusionists who kind of kicked off the current diffusionist movement or gave it a new impetus back in the 1970s with a couple books he published showing, or at least we seem to find Ogham in America, which would be a cipher, which was often encoded with the Celtic language. And this began, you know, as soon as people start feeling it's a forum, much like the Ormus Forum, they come forth. And we had all kinds of people and groups forming to investigate pre-Columbian contacts in America. Well, I ran into this circle of people in Colorado. Carl Lehrberger, who's online with us now, has been by my side on many of these discoveries, starting with my interviews with him. I interviewed him and other people in Colorado. There are a number of Ogham sites there. And as we interviewed them, I got interested in looking for Ogham elsewhere. I couldn't see how they could have possibly gotten from the Atlantic all the way across to California, but there were claims of this. And as I was doing this, I was also moving, and I decided to put this show on the road again. I bought myself a big fifth wheel and decided to put a studio in there. So here I am now, background in science, catastrophism, etheric physics, as well as many, many years when I was younger, experimenting with, let's just call it, the current name would be entheogen, but almost 10 years. I had a lot of connections. I had a lot of experiences. So these backgrounds are critical to understanding what I'm going to call the two worlds story. Two worlds meaning that there was a knowledge of America going back, or the continents, North and South America, going back for as long as I can trace it. I've been able to get back to at least 24,000 years, and I'm sure it's before that. And never is there a disconnection. Whenever you have a story of America and that people are coming here, they're coming here with a knowledge of alchemy, they're coming here with a knowledge of astrology. These two are clearly merged throughout America. And at the time, I didn't know this, and so I'm looking in California for signs of Ogham. I'm about to go down and do some research. And I get an impression, and I think that as a scientist, I'm more of a deductive scientist. I wait for impressions. I let intuition guide me. And the impression I got was a question. And it came, and I understand many trees, all trees actually, being electrical in nature. In fact, in desert environments, you'll always find spiny objects, not just cactus. You know, you've got tarantulas with spines. Everything has points to discharge electrical energy. And I knew that pine trees had these, and one of the reasons they grow. That's part of our theory. And as I contemplated that, the thought came into my head, why are the bristlecone pine trees in California so old? Now, for those of you who don't know, bristlecone pines can be at least 4,600 years old. That's a long time. And I'm sending some images back. My wife's uploading some now to Barry, and hopefully he'll put them on his site and you can look at them. One of the first ones up there is a picture of a bristlecone pine tree. There's a couple of them. One of them is growing out of a solid piece of dolomite. Now, dolomite is a magnesium and calcium carbonate. Actually, we probably call it a calcium magnesium carbonate. It's usually about 21-22% elemental calcium and about 12% magnesium. And this stuff is about 4% of the earth. I mean, it's everywhere, and the people don't even understand exactly how it forms. We think we have a good idea now. But it's tied in with life. It isn't just calcium, which can form normally under mineral conditions. It seems to be tied in a lot with life. There may be exceptions. The dolomite is actually formed by the first organisms on earth that that ever lived. They were eating rock for a living. Now, as Ormus eaters, as you know, everybody doing Ormus is essentially involved in what many scientists call geophagy, because in a sense we're consuming minerals and rock, processing them, but people used to eat them straight. Dolomite was one of the things they ate. And this will come clear in a minute why this is so prevalent. But here's this tree. One of the pictures is a tree growing straight out of a piece of dolomite about 8,000, 9,000 feet up in an area called the White Mountains, which is the Inyo Mountain Range, northern part of the Inyo Mountain Range in California. This is between the Sierra Nevada Range and Owens Valley and the deeper deserts out towards Death Valley. Now, these things are really, really old. And so when that thought came to me, I said, well, why are they growing that old? And I began to investigate this. This is what happened. I went down to California to look at these bristlecone pines. I went up into the forest, looked at the soil they were growing in, and I hadn't discovered the dolomite connection yet, and this is a huge connection to the Ormus community. Dolomite can, in my opinion, contain very high levels, particularly of copper and silver ormeth, which I have renamed umpas, and I'll explain that a little bit later. But we went to a site in California that was near this area, and I was led there by a man who'd spent a number of years working on this site, and he thought there was ogham there. That's why I was down there. And I went on this site. I didn't see any ogham. But what I did see startled me. I was looking at what scientists often call abstract petroglyphs, petroglyphs being carved rock.
So before you launch into that particular area, would you explain a couple of things? Firstly, why is it, do you think, that people were eating this dolomite?
Well, I can tell you why. I'll get to that right away. But what I was stunned by was the amount of petroglyphs decided.
And the other thing I wanted to ask is that because I didn't get a chance to do a proper introduction of you. I just asked how you got into Ormus, and you kind of just took a flying leap at our material here. So perhaps I'll interrupt and ask you to, because I had a couple of people write to me on the web and say, well, what's the man got his PhD in? What's his background? So, and I normally start with that. So would you fill us in so people know the kind of depth of background that you have that you're speaking from?
Okay, well, I'll tell you right now, if I'd had a PhD, I never would have found this. In science, PhDs are people who focus on one area. In order to make discoveries in neocatastrophism, this is an integrated, interdisciplinary science. It's the same, really, with Ormus. I mean, if you're going to go into alchemy, you need a background. You need a background in astrology, because you have to know something about the nature of planetary motion, how it affects these chemistries, and I'll explain this in a minute, too. You need a background. So, you know, if you're locked into a PhD, you're very unlikely to investigate this because you already have all the answers. And I've been around these people all my life. I got a bachelor's in illustration, another design, a degree in design. I left the marine biology field that I was in because I was disgusted with the closed-minded nature of scientists. Anyway, so I'm down at this site and with an open mind and a background many, many years in various sciences. And here are these petroglyphs which don't seem abstract at all. In fact, one of the first things I noticed was that one of these symbols from some of the research I'd done into esotericism appeared to be the sign of prima materia, or the sign of the quintessence. And I'll make this pretty short. This site turned out to have more solar and lunar. We proved, not only proved this, but we predicted at least four lunar alignments here. This just means points at which the moon will come up, align directly to a rock, which will have a target on it, which will have basically ways to track the light. Usually it's going to be a pyramid of light. These are people who put these here, people that were careful to monitor the nature of the movement of the planets to do their alchemy. Now, this site is full of holes, so one of the largest mortar holes in California, about 16 inches, 18 inches across, and about 20 inches down into solid dolomite. This is a this particular site was one of a number in the area which have dolomite. And this particular site was used by more people than we could possibly imagine. We can date this by some of the petroglyphs at least back to 4,000 BCE, and it probably goes back much further. Now, this site blew me away. Now, I went there many, many times, and Carl Lehrberger, who's online with us, was with me on many of those occasions. He's been there by himself without me as well, looking at the alignments. And I would say, I want Carl to put a little note in here. Carl, do you know of any other sites in the world where the lunar and solar alignments are this numerous at one site?
No, there seems to be more alignments at this particular site, both equinox, solstice, and cross-quarter day alignments for morning and evening, and presumably a couple of noon alignments as well. So we've seen over a dozen. And there may be another dozen alignments at different times of the year that are very intentional at this one site.
Yeah, and I found at least a couple myself. And in fact, we predicted four of them. And this is where it gets interesting. On the images I sent Barry, if he gets them up, you'll see an image of what looks like a two-cube-high man with a pyramid head. And there's a little phallus sticking off of him at the appropriate spot, and there's a little pyramid on top of there. Now, this was very carefully hidden in the rocks, and we found that. We said, okay, what is this doing here? There must be something, because this is a symbol. This symbol comes up as a symbol for Lu. It also, Lu was one of the gods of the Celts. You've also got Belinus and other variations of that, and the reason you care about that as an alchemist is because Belinus is linked back into Cernunnos, who was you'll see him as the yoga guy, seated next. He's got stag horns on his head. He's next to a deer, a red deer is what they call him technically. And this guy's got a lot of points on him. And he's cross-legged, sitting yoga, holding an Ouroboros in one hand and a serpent in the other, on the front of the most famous, probably the most famous cauldron in the world, which is the silver cauldron of Gundestrup. This is found in Germany. Now, why is this important? I can tell you now, we don't have how much time we have online to do this, but this site in California was linked to sites around the world. The same marks, we found them in Switzerland. We found them in what used to be called Dilmun back in the days of Mesopotamia, which is actually in this valley. We found them on the Susquehanna River in the east coast, just north of Washington, D.C. In fact, it's directly on a ley line that runs to the four cities of the Revolution, which, as most of you may know, was an esoteric attempt by the Masons to line these things up for religious and spiritual reasons. This same ley line runs right through Stonehenge, runs right through what used to people think of as Troy. It was really an esoteric temple at one point, right through Baalbek, one of the most ancient sites in the world, the largest stones in the world. They make Stonehenge stones look small. Right around the world to Teotihuacan, one of the hot spots in Mexico, and, of course, Temple of Sun and Moon, alignments, all sorts of things. This is a global network of people who came in and did these things. And we have determined, my theory is that these people, after these comet disasters, after so many thousand years, usually about 900 years apart for a number of thousands of years, would come in and reunite the world, give them technology, teach them to process what is being called Ormus today, which I call Umpas, M-State, call it what you will, out of the minerals, particularly in the Great Basin. They were active in the Midwest and East Coast as well, but they were very, very active in the Great Basin. In the Mojave Desert alone, there are over 2,000 petroglyph sites. Some of these sites, there are as many as 10 to 15,000 petroglyphs in a single canyon. Do the math. Now, who was doing this? Why would they do it? So I'll tell you, on the site, Barry gets these up. I've sent a bunch of images. You'll see some images from an area called Surprise Tank. Have Carl tell you, how old do you think some of these are in Surprise Tank? How old are some of the petroglyphs there, Carl? What do you think?
Well, petroglyphs are tough to date, but one way you can gauge a kind of a general time frame is by the patina or the buildup of the lichen and microscopic materials where they pecked or made a groove in the mark. And these particular petroglyphs are so patinaed that the color of the patina is almost the same as the background rock itself. So clearly, these are very old sites, at least 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, perhaps even older. We just don't know, but they're very old sites.
In fact, in Surprise Tank, now this is why it's important to understand what you're seeing. Surprise Tank was built on the end of a small caldera. It's actually a small, I wouldn't call it a cinder mound, but it was a small volcano back at the time of Christ, about 2,000 years ago, and before that for a long time. California and way up and down the coast, I mean, all the way down to Mexico and further, was very active, more than it is today. Volcanoes were everywhere. And they would.
And so what were people using this stuff for, Dorian?
Okay, well, I'll tell you. In the volcano, if you want to make this stuff, and I'll go back to Sir Nunes for a second. Sir Nunes has a counterpart. Sir Nunes goes back to around the Gundestrup cauldron. I think they've dated it to a few hundred B.C. But Sir Nunes, this god with the horn, has a counterpart called Pashupati in India. This would be the Indus Valley. We're talking about 4,000 BCE here. Same God. I'm going to tell you right now, I won't reveal this in this show. There's not enough time. But if we go on again, I'll show you why I'm saying what I'm saying now. These were directly linked to particular chemistries involved in alchemy. One of them was used all over the place in the world. It was salammoniac, which is ammonia carbonate.
Well, salammoniac is urine. The urine method, basically, when you put lime in urine to get out all the fecal matter, it is salammoniac. And so basically, when air contacted, it just basically sucks in all the ormus from the air.
Salammoniac is also the precursor. If you want to make hydrochloric acid, you can use this. You can sublimate the crystals off. Now, why did I bring this up? Well, this tank, which means essentially it's like a ravine where water ran down from this volcano, was marked extensively with petroglyphs that were all alchemical. But this is the first time this has been published or been discussed openly. The group that we were dealing with is a closed group of about 25, 30 individuals who have been keeping this secret for a number of years. And I'm telling you now, we're now going public with this. In Surprise Tank, I've given you three examples of multiple symbols. We've got nitre, the symbol for nitric acid. We've got phthalammoniac. In fact, it's doubled. You'll see one site where there's a one phthalammoniac symbol, which is a kind of a pine cone shape with a cube, a little square off the end of it. This is extremely Mesopotamian. And next to it is another is an asterism, which is also another symbol for phthalammoniac. There's no question that this is what was intended there, and this is where you'd find it. You walk up that canyon about half a mile, and you can pick it right off the volcano 2,000 years ago. This was used extensively. Pashupati, Sir Nunes, all of these link right back to phthalammoniac, and we can show this. I guess we won't have time to do this now, but it was coded into the very shape and structure of these gods. So this is an alchemical... Okay, shall I continue?
Well, I'd like to, and I'm still hanging out to find out why people are eating dolomite.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that. I'm going to introduce the word prima materia. Now, prima materia for ancient alchemists was a term for any mineral which contained the quintessence. The quintessence, or the quinta essentia, in my opinion, and this is what I've learned from years of studying this now and doing it myself in the laboratory, there are probably a number of quote-unquote warmest compounds. Platinum could be one of them, you know, a la Hudson. However, the ancients seem to prefer five of them, which I think and I believe are the primary five that deal with health and vitality in the human body. And those would be copper, silver, moving up atomically up the numbers, rhodium, iridium, and gold, and in that order. Now, at some of these sites, you will see a stack of five circles. These five circles read right to left. They didn't read left to right back then, and we're talking very old times here. The stack represents the quinta essentia, and to the left of that, the next statement looks like the sign for Leo. Well, that's the sign also for digestion. In other words, if you're going to take a rock and you're going to start breaking it apart, you have to grind it and pulverize it. We've seen the symbol for pulvis all over the place, which is this kind of a ladder design, and it means to pulverize the rock. And so they would pulverize or grind it. Most of the grinding holes in the Great Basin are not used. They were not used for acorns. We've got some of these grinding holes are holes or mortars or holes where somebody's taken a metal tool, a very strong metal tool in some cases, and ground holes anywhere from the size of maybe your thumb up to 18 inches across. And well, we've seen very large ones too, but those may have been baptismal fonts, and middle-sized ones were probably used for grinding food. But many of these sites, these holes, there's no way they ground food. They're too deep in, they're too narrow, and you can feel it was drilled with metal tools. And this is not just dolomite. Dolomite I call the green dragon. This particular stone was spoken of in many ancient texts by many different references, but it appears to be primarily dolomite. And now if you look at, I can go into this more at another time, but basically there were three sorts of minerals that were used. The dolomites were used because they were easy to process and they contained the green dragon. If any of you are familiar with the term menstruum, which is an alchemical term, a menstruum isn't just a solvent. The reason astrology and alchemy get so tied together at the hip may well be because what we're seeing is an etheric phenomenon both in planetary conjunctions and occultation as well as in the atomic world. Terms like van der Waals effects and terms like Casimir effects, these relate to atomic reactions at very, very small distances. And just kind of like people talk about dark matter, which I don't believe in, but I believe in ether, but because of these effects, they say, oh, there's dark matter, something pushing out there. Well, the same thing happens in water, in a solution, when ormus gets involved. And dolomite can have a very high level of copper and silver. I'm going to give you an example of this, and this is an interesting word.
Before you do, please tell us, why would someone eat dolomite? What's the benefit?
Okay, well, there's two. Actually, dolomite is calcium carbonate and magnesium carbonate, primarily those two. You will find dirty dolomite that has other minerals to hide, you know, sometimes more lead than you'd like or arsenic. The product that we're manufacturing is actually some of the cleanest dolomite in the world. The parts per million of, for example, of lead are down below 0.85 parts per million. So it's very, very clean, the dolomite.
Yeah, okay, good. But why would you eat it?
Okay, when you break the dolomite up, in alchemical terms, the term would be salt. Salt would be the mineral that we're digesting. To release the quintessentia, we have to digest the rock. Now, dolomite is generally an alkaline rock, which will form in the same vicinity as other alkaline stone, and things like lead, arsenic. There's a number of things that appear in these stones, so sometimes you have to be careful. But this particular dolomite, at this site, it turns out that these grinding holes, these alignments, were marking a site which was used as a temple for obtaining these chemistries right out of the dolomite. These grinding holes were sometimes aligned to the cross-quarter days, which are in between the equinoxes and solstices. And they were the sacred days.
But you haven't told me why. What's the benefit for eating it?
Well, because it's high in
copper. It's dormant.
Copper and silver primarily, but it doesn't always. Now, here's the thing. My background was, as I say, in a number of fields. One of them was neocatastrophism, one of the study of impact science. Large impactors, very large objects hitting the Earth at incredible speeds, a lot of mass. When you see these things hit, they'll punch a hole right through a planet. Mars, Helios Planitia, it's a huge 1,200-mile-wide impact basin. On the other side is the largest volcano we know of in the solar system. We saw this with Chicxulub. People didn't believe this years ago, and this is one of the theories I worked on, and it was correct. When we get hit by Chicxulub, almost directly across at that time in India with the Deccan Flats, an area where the Earth broke open and the salt flooded because of the impact. The pressure from the seismic waves literally ripped the Earth open. This area in California is around the Sierra Nevada Range. The Sierra Nevada Range is another rift in the Earth. It wasn't caused by just by plate, like we're told, plate shifting. It was an impact-related disaster. And so when you and there's a number of them. There was a large one 350 million years ago, 120 miles north of Nevada. There's also one in Ship Rock, which appears to be an impact. I think it's an impact, not a volcanic, they call it a volcanic throat, I think the term is, a neck. But anyway, the point is that impact science is directly related to Ormus potential. If you've got these seed metals, these quintessentia, which can turn into metals, or they can turn into Ormus, they do so under pressure and heat. There, in other words, certain pressures and certain temperatures. There are three types of stone that contain Ormus, the alkaline rocks or the green dragon. These are metals that would love to become metals. They don't want to become Ormus. Copper is very tough to get Ormus out of. Silver is not that hard, but it's still a lot more rare than gold, iridium, and rhodium, believe it or not. And it's these chemicals that are these quintessentia, these of the seed metals, that are there on certain conditions. We see it in impact sites around the world. The reason I mentioned Susquehanna, if you look at the Chesapeake impactor, where one of the ripples, one of the pulse waves kind of stopped in the rock, that's where they were digging this stuff. You look in the Great Basin, there's a number of ripples from these impacts. That's where they're eating this stuff. This has never been understood. But the Magi, or I'm going to call them that for the sake of argument, the people who spread this around the world, who were teaching basically esoteric science, astrology, and mineralogy to Americans, and people living here in this continent, knew this technology. They knew how to find comet impact zones. And not just comets, you'll also get this in volcanic environment. This would be the red dragon. Well, there's two. The red dragon is the extreme.
What are the other two stones that there's? Okay, we know about the green dragon dolomite. What are the other two?
The red dragon will be silica-based rock. And again, the key to all this will be. I'll tell you in a second. I'll drop it on you. But this is what most people are pulling out of seawater. They're pulling it out of dolomite. They're pulling it out of silica-based rock. So the red dragon would be those quintessentia, probably gold, iridium, rhodium, primarily, which are forming inside of the... So we have it forming under pressure. Now, there's an old code in the Old Testament for this, and it discusses, you know, the tree of life being not hidden, but the weight of the tree of life being kept by the flaming sword and by cherubim. Cherubim are basically floating flames or floating light, or earthquake light, or the lightning we see, piezoelectric lightning in some cases, caused by volcanic pressure. So the red dragon forms under volcanic pressure, but controlled pressure. If you have an eruption like Mount St. Helens and you blow the top off these rocks, well, you'll find Ormus-based rocks around for 150, 200, 300 miles wherever they land, but it's hard to collect them. But if you can find an area with a controlled temperature, usually basalt can have it. We've seen many sites with basalt rich in pyroxenes, which will be a high magnesium pyroxene, by the way, and there's your key. Also in andesite and gabbro, we'll find these. Now, there's a third type of rock that bridges the two. The red if the red dragon is these is silica-based rock that's formed, the quintessential forms under the right pressure and temperature conditions, the green dragon forms either by cyanobacteria collecting magnesium. It's part of the it's the center of the chlorophyll atom. These things, magnesium will form a condition which is conducive to trapping Ormus. But also we get higher Ormus potential during impacts on these old limestone and dolomitic limestone beds. There's a third type of rock, and this will be metamorphic rock. This is California, for example, where the plate under the Pacific is grinding away at our plate here, the main plate under America and the west side. As it grinds, it takes the green dragon, these dolomitic limestone layers, grinds it together with silica-based rocks, or the red dragon, and forms a rock that will have both characteristics. Stonehenge, in my opinion, is exactly that, and before the discovery this last year, that's what they call spotted dolomite, which is really, it's not really a dolomite, it's really a metamorphic rock formed from limestone and silica-based rock ground together about 150 miles.
There's a fourth one. Stonehenge.
Pardon me?
There's a fourth stone that you don't, that you haven't mentioned. It's called the Bogie Stone. Well, the thing is that they're actually found in naturally occurring pyramids. When a volcano erupts, sometimes certain material that comes out of that volcano is a certain resonant temperature, and for some reason a pyramid forms that looks like a regular pyramid, except it's a naturally shaped pyramid that's just solid earth, and then about one-third of the way from the pyramid and one-third of the way from the base and one-third of the way from the top, it's like a tree, and you will find this kind of rock grow, and it has branches out now, and the fruit that comes out of it are these little rocks called Bogie stones. You can buy them online, and the thing is that if I have several Bogie stones, and I put them in a pyramid, and these Bogie stones just ooze powder constantly, and that's the fourth one.
Well, again, that would though qualify under the magmatic rock, the igneous rock category. Though it may be a specific stone. That is a fascinating story. I've never heard that before. But again, that would fall under the red dragon category, clearly within magmatic rock. So we have magmatic rock on the high end, and this is the red dragon because it's volatile. You can't capture this stuff and control it very easily, as people who make gold ormus will tell you. But the green dragon is easy to control. You can break down dolomite with hydrochloric acid. I tend to do it very, very quickly with a very strong hydrochloric, very dry, which is giving off it's all about gassing and it's dangerous. I use a big hood for this, but I found it works best when it's done that way. If I put it in a solution, it's it doesn't act as quickly. I don't think I get as strong an ormus out of it. However, there are other ways to do it. But hydrochloric acid is a very simple way if you have access to that and you don't mind fanning away this hydrochloric acid because you get some fumes out of there. It's pretty dangerous. But they were using milder forms. Now, they often oxidized their rock. They would burn it to an ash. And it took a lot of heat to burn dolomite because it's used in refineries. I mean, it's actually a good stone to spread heat around, but it will eventually break down. And so there are also symbols on these rocks to suggest you should calcinate. This is very important because around the world we have pictures of sheep. And if you look on these pictures that Barry puts these up, you'll see I give you a bunch of pictures of these odd-looking.
I've got the pictures up. And
okay, well,
just so people will know, they're at subtleenergies.com/Ormus/PW/Dorian, Dorian.htm.
Okay, Barry, thanks.
This is links, but you can't click on them, because a lot of them have spaces in them so they wouldn't link properly. So you'll have to copy the whole link and paste it into your browser.
Okay, I'm going to go down through this for just a second because the images are online, and I'm going to go run through this very, very quickly, and you'll see as you look on there, I had a comet up as the first image, very famous alchemical emblem as the second
one.
These
aren't in any sequence.
Well, there was a number sequence on them. The first three letters.
The numbers were only the first four or five.
Oh.
Items, so.
Uh-oh. I think my wife may have uploaded the wrong one. We'll get you the new ones. I'm going to run through these very, very quickly.
Can you repeat the link, please?
subtleenergies.com/Ormus, O-R-M-U-S, /TW, /Dorian, D-O-R-I-A-N dot H-T-M.
Yeah.
No, T-W as in trap water.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so to run through these quickly, if you look, and I'll get them up in order to you, Barry. My wife was sending some of these. She probably got the wrong one. They run through a series of images of this beautiful picture of this, and I don't know how old this tree is, probably 3,000, 2,500 years, but it's a one of the Briscombe pines on top of growing straight out of this dolomitic rock, and you'll see a map kind of pointing more or less to the area. I'm going to call it Mojave, but I'm not going to give specific spots. We don't talk about these sites because they're being degraded as we talk. There's vandals and other people coming in. We don't want people going in there to dig up these historic sites. They should be heritage sites, and, you know, with pickaxes to get out, to get access to rock. I can tell you this rock is around the world. If you know where to find it, the ancients marked it. They marked it everywhere. But anyway, you'll see that one of the first things we discovered were esoteric links to things like the Tree of Life in these symbols. And I've shown you a symbol. I want it's a site where you can see literally prima materia, or it's actually the word quintessence, the cross with a little circle on top. And you have to count these backwards. The Indians, this is Indian alchemy now. This is Indonesian. This is Armenian alchemy. It's not what we're familiar with from either the medieval period or from later Europe, post-Renaissance. But you'll see a symbol with a cross. If you read it counterclockwise in the top corner, it's air, fire, earth. And in the earth segment, there's a symbol for lead, a circle with a line down. And in water, there's a symbol for the water, a seven-twist curve with arsenic attached to it. There's arsenic in the water. There's arsenic sulfide in the water right at this site. And lead is prevalent in the rock. So they're warning you about taking your dolomite from this particular location. And the next slide would have been one. It's from Kunjarab Path. This is Pakistan going into, in fact, the Tarim Basin where the big red-haired mummies were found. And you'll see there's a comparison. This is basically the pulverized symbol, which means it's telling you to grind this rock. It's also a symbol that would later be also kind of integrated into the Sephiroth. It's linked in a way. And you'll see this from Kunjarab Path, identical except for the bottom part of it with this site in California. Now, why is that interesting? Because this is a two-world thing. You'll see they flip these symbols upside down for our world. India, the Indus Valley, is directly antipodal, at least in terms of our hemisphere, to the Great Basin. This was what they used to call Lanka. This was Atlan. This was Avalon. This was Atlantis. America was the place they knew about. It was a very sacred land, and they came here to teach, and they also came here, and as they traveled, they went to these sites, not just dolomite sites to get dolomite. They also did it with the Red Dragon Rock. They were
so America was like the underworld.
America was El Dorado, Barry. This was the Great Basin. Was this? It had many names, but it was where they came to teach. In fact, they began bringing people in. A great book by Gene Matlock called India Once Ruled the Americas. He hit the nail on the head. Later on, they were bringing people out of Brahmanic India to save these righteous people, small tribes and groups, and dumped them off here. Some died, some made it. The Hopi, the Navajo, the Zuni, the Apaches were warriors, the Ta'anoa Odom, all are Indian. All came from India, Indus Valley, and then later India. And I give you a site from Sears Point. You'll see more of these consciousness symbols. And you'll see a bunch of sheep images. I mean, these are not sheep. They're cauldrons. And you'll see them three at a time. The Magi always traveled in threes. Sometimes you'll see long lines of them, where they were migrations, where they came in over and over again.
Well, during the medieval times, from all the history I've studied, it seemed as though before Columbus, all of the kings and queens of every nation knew about America. It's just they kept it a secret. The question I have is, you talked about one of the things you need to know when you delve into alchemy is about the astrological and the astronomy knowledge. Is there a particular way you can easily find that out, a website or a study course or something?
I'd say there's a number of websites where astrology is mentioned, not sometimes in terms of alchemy. There's a wonderful book. I put this aside a minute ago. So I was going to try to get the address online to Barry. There's a wonderful book on Spagyric art, and I'm trying to think of what the name of it is right now, but he was a student. You know, Barry would know there was an alchemist teaching in Utah for a number of years, quite well known during the 1970s. He's passed on now, but a couple of his students carried on after him, and a couple of them wrote books. And one of the books by one of those students is very, very insightful into astrology. In fact, points to the absolute link. If you're going to just make ormus from dolomite, you can get an awful powerful ormus that way, and even other ormuses. But if you're going to make the philosopher's stone, it's not going to work. I don't have time to go into that today, but I think I understand the nature of the philosopher's stone, why these alchemical processes were required to be run at certain times. We did tests with this particular dolomite that I'm selling now. I do sell it. You can make ormus out of it if you want. I certainly won't stop you, and nobody will. I do sell the elixir itself. I'm actually calling it what it was. It was named Amrita and Soma. This is the real stuff from India. That's what they did. Same process. These people knew how to do it. I did duplicates. Very simple process. But they produce this all the time. It's thousands of years. It was the most famous of these because it was not hard to make. In fact, this is the ancient legend that they called the churning of the ocean of milk. Literally, when you take a dolomitic, if you break it down with hydrochloric acid, you'll end up with magnesium hydroxide with some calcium hydroxide, and it's pretty inevitable. And if you squeeze it out as best you can, you decant it off and wash it several times, you still get some sodium chloride in there if you use lye to process it, to basify, and that's what they did. So you have something which is slightly salty, which tastes like milk. This is the churning of the sea of milk. This is amrit. This is the basis for yoga. This is all based in this, and I'm going to go back to these pictures real quick so I can get done before our time's up. I want to cover a couple
things. Before you do, Dorian, let me just ask you this. So far, even though I've kind of asked you a few times, you haven't given me one benefit, one reason for taking any of this stuff. Would you please address why one would even have any of these products, besides the fact that they're enormous? I mean, let's just presume no one knows anything. What is the benefit in experience? What is the benefit in lifestyle? What's the benefit in consciousness? What are the benefits that you have personally detected and has been written about in the stuff that you have studied, that people have talked about the experience of this, that, and the other in their lives? What are those experiences?
Okay, well, increased consciousness is normal with most enormous products of any sort. We have had 25, 30 people testing this. These are people within our group. We called it the Circle of Azoth. It was a private group that was funding this. And as a rule, now this depends on their lifestyle, but if they're living a lifestyle that's healthy to begin with, and they consume this product, particularly if they consume magnesium with it. Now, we don't just sell Ormus because that's not enough. Your diet isn't correct. If you don't have calcium, magnesium, you can forget it. And there's other essential minerals, but those two need to be balanced. And dolomite, they're pretty balanced. That's one of the reasons they took it from that source, because not that the hydroxide is going to give you. The hydroxide won't work as a supplement. But we sell the dolomite by itself, along with zectine oil. I won't go into this right now, but zectine, you can trap. And, in fact, this gentleman's response about these little stones that look like pyramid shaped. Well, if you look at the structure of magnesium chloride hexahydrate, it's a bipyramidal shape. If you look at magnetite, which can be used to charge and drag through the ether in the form of field, it will energize the stuff. I sell devices to do this. They're the magnetite meow devices, and most of you probably have heard about them. I make them too. I call them an M-vortexer. But these devices are what Stonehenge was, in a sense, although it's not exactly the same thing. But you do your elixir, you put it in these, and it charges the water. We've done tests on this. We've got 30 people almost who've done this now, 24 of them for over 2 years, and basically we don't get bacterial infection. We don't get sick. Now, we may get viruses. That's a different story. But even those, the immune system becomes so beefed up, we don't get sick. I think one of the main reasons why people did this was for extended health. It was called the nectar of immortality. It was called the elixir of life. It was called many things, as well as Amrita and Soma. But this stuff alone, if it's done every day, basically beefs you up. I mean, you don't get sick anymore, and you feel wonderful. It's energetic. You know, like most Ormus products, the brain appreciates it, too. You become very in tune. People have had all kinds of responses. The stuff that we're producing from this particular dolomite is so strong. I don't know what else. I haven't sampled every Ormus product out there, I'll tell you right now. But I think this is from people that have, and have a lot of them, people who are making, trying to make Huston's formula, have remarked at the strength of this. And I think this goes to show you that if you find the right stone, it's not just any dolomite, it's the right dolomite. I'm going to give you a site. I'm not going to tell you most of them, but I'll tell you this one because it's a heritage site. It's already protected, but it's something you should know. It's a fabulous story because it links right back into Orme, the word O-R-M-E. There is a site in the west coast of Wales. It's a peninsula that's basically an outcropping of a very rich copper dolomite, and it sticks out into the ocean. It was used by the Vikings for thousands of years. Their word for this was O-R-M-E, Orme. It meant serpent. And most of you who know about the use of Ormus over time, you'll know that the huge sound becomes quite prevalent, the sound that isn't the sound, the nada, in the head. This stuff will do that. Within a few weeks of doing this, most of us hear this, and it continues, unless there's some physical reason why you don't hear the hue at all, but most of us do. But anyway, it's called the Great Orme, O-R-M-E. And it's this huge outcropping, and they were drilling into this thousands and thousands of years ago, at least 3,500 BC. And the initial drilling wasn't for copper ore. There are grinding holes. They were clearly using it. This is on the back slope of the Great Orme. They were using it as an orme source. This, again, was Dominic limestone. Around the world, there are sites in India, in every part of the world, in Brazil, every place where they could sail to, they drilled dolomite. Now, they also drilled the other, the Red Dragon, but it wasn't as prevalent. And my opinion about this is just my feeling, is that these copper and silver are really the real healing tools of the Ormus world, and they're harder to find. But they're not hard to find in the correct dolomite, but you have to know where it is. These Magi, these ancient Anunnaki, when they were giants, we call them Anunnaki, but these people that traveled the world left their mark everywhere. And if you can read those marks, if you can read the rocks in both lands, you can become extremely healthy. The Native American people in this country respected these guys so much that they drew and petroglyphs all the time. I mean, maybe Carl could take just a second. Carl, tell them some of these wonderful images of the Magi in, for example, Renegade Canyon in Coso.
Theory of being able to read the rocks and follow them back in time, leading to, you know, ancients with, you know, great esoteric wisdom and knowledge of many different fields, including metallurgy and astronomy and being able to build orientations so you get these, you know, really quite fantastic alignments that take place at these times. And I think these sites can be read, many of them, for their esoteric old world meanings. And but that knowledge seems to have digressed over time. So it's one of those things that is lost. A legitimate way of really looking at the alchemetic and esoteric traditions of these ancient ones is through their rock art. And it's really a cutting-edge field, and really Dorian has a lot to contribute to it.
I want to make a comment here. When you're starting to get into the Anunnaki, I want to clarify so people don't make a mistake. The Anunnaki, well, when you're getting into Ormus, you're starting along their path. And their path isn't the best one, because they're the ones that made a hybrid of themselves, according to the ancient texts I've read, and did genetic manipulation, and then they put them in a garden to make God for the to make food for the gods. They considered themselves to be gods, and that's how humanity came to being. Humanity really came into being because we were genetically messed with to be slaves for this higher race, and they were dependent upon this stuff for their immortality, because they had relative immortality, where they would live for a very long time if they didn't have some accident or something. We lived thousands of years.
Hence the Greek legends and stories about the gods of immortality and so on. The fable and descriptions of these kind of characters.
Yeah, but, you know, the problem with mythology is depends on who's telling the story. You know, the churning of the Sea of Milk comes through the Vedic writings. It's in the Puranas. It's all over India, all over Indonesia. It was retold. And there's two characters. There's the antagonist, essentially, and the protagonist. Protagonist usually the divas, and the antagonist would be the the divas are the antagonist, and the asuras, or the Asir, if you're in the Nordic world, would be the demigods or the gods. People always put themselves in the position of the good guy, and the bad guy was the other guy.
There is two different stories, and one person is lying, and the other one has to be telling the truth, and that's a big debate. I won't say my opinion, but what I do know for a fact is that Ormus and the Philosopher's Stone and these elixirs, they create a kind of spin effect, and they also heal the DNA. Well, what really, if you're not using this, what keeps you alive? Well, this golden mean ratio that has the spin that creates life, because that's how light manifests onto the world, with this through the golden mean ratio, because of the sacred geometry of the earth and all that kind of fun stuff. Basically, you become dependent upon it. You become like the serpent race or the Anunnaki. And I've met a lot of alchemists who are uncaring, real a-holes who have no compassion, and they're really mean. And the reason why they are that way is because they have lost their emotion factor of supporting their life for that spin, for that love. and they become dependent upon this stuff. That's what I do know for sure, is that you take this stuff to enhance your spirituality, not to become, and to enhance your life, but do not become dependent upon it.
Do you have any evidence that we're not all dependent upon it all the time by breathing and eating and drinking water?
Yeah, Barry. See, I agree with Barry here. I mean, this stuff, gold...
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. And I think gold particularly, in my understanding, the gold warmest is everywhere. I mean, it's everywhere because it doesn't turn it... It doesn't like to turn into metal. And this is why copper goes the other way. Now, I don't have time to get into the full theory because it's really based in Christology. It's based in etheric physics. It isn't guesswork. And most of the decisions I've made in processing this last few years have been successful because I followed a particular premise. What's that? Okay, it was dropping after a minute. What I wanted to say was there may be people whose opinion is that the Anunnaki, in this case, or others, have become nasty people because of warmth. Anything we obsess over, anything where we lose touch with humanity is a problem. My hope is that this discovery will spurn people to look at the universe a different way. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing Ormus, but it's like anything else. You need food, you need air and light, and you need to love people. I mean, there's a famous story of Gilgamesh. One of the giants fought another giant, and then they got to be friends. And one giant tells him, hey, have you heard about the immortality elixir? And Gilgamesh was all for it. This is in the Gilgamesh epic in Mesopotamia. And as the story goes, he seeks a man whose wisdom has let him understand how to use the elixir and make it, and he seeks him out. And after he finally gets an interview with him, and the story is embedded with all sorts of alchemical code, he finally has a visit with him, and the guy basically tells him, look, what do you want? He says, Gilgamesh says, I want immortality. I want the elixir. And he says, you know what you do? You go back to Mesopotamia, and you spend 20 years serving your people, loving these people. And if you can do that for 20 years, you come back, and I'll give you the elixir. Now, that was a code. And every 19 full Metonic years, the moon comes up and aligns itself in exactly the same position. In the pictures I sent, you'll see a predicted event. This is not something I discovered by random accident. It was predicted, and it was exactly where it was supposed to be. You stand in a target, you look at a rock, and the moon comes up exactly full every 19 years minus 2 hours. And this is the Metonic cycle. I could go into this all day, but this was a code for the ancient esoterics. And, it's not Ormus that corrupts people. It's spirituality, the lack thereof. And yes, one can be cocky. Talk to an actor who's done cocaine. Does cocaine corrupt people? No. People corrupt people. Cocaine helps. Can a person do too much Ormus? I don't know. I suppose they can do too much food or too little. They can spend time primping in the mirror. I just don't want to condemn the ancient people.
Several people have died lately drinking too much water.
Well, we should cut that out, Barry. But I guess what I'm saying is let me try to sum up. Let me try to sum up here. Let's end it because there's a lot of other images on the site. I try to get them.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and try to get them. I could go through the whole story. You'll see some of the rocks from Black Tank. You'll see the Salomoniac symbols. You'll see this god from Tassili. You'll see that he had a cone. A head looked like a bee. And, of course, it's mushrooms. It's a psilocybin link. But that same symbol was used by the Anunnaki, and it's called a Singib. And the head of the Anunnaki becomes, later on, a symbol for the very menstruum that they were using to process much of the rock, and particularly Dolomitic limestone, which was Salmoniac. These symbols go round and round and round, and I've given you some. I've given you some of these images, and you'll see that they were tying it back into the ecliptic of the Earth. They understood crystal principles. They understood how to process astronomy. In fact, I didn't get a chance to tell you that most of these sites are embedded with astrological marks for the Masonic cycle, for the short-term Nishakra cycle, which is 3 years, and they counted off leap years of 11 days, and they would get up 3 years where the moon would come back to the same position. This encodes the Staro cycle, which gives you the eclipses. And this is a 99-year Octoterus cycle. All of these are around the world on these rocks and have been missed by archaeologists who think that these are primitive people. There are primitive people. There are people who went back in and didn't know the stuff and would repeck one image until you had 3-inch deep holes in some of these. They'd repeck a sheep forever because it was a symbol. But basically, we're talking about a revival of ancient alchemy. We can now understand who they were. They came from India, Indus Valley. They came from Anatolia, from Mesopotamia. And they brought with them the knowledge of astrology and astronomy, how to use the elixir wisely, how to integrate the red and green dragons, and basically came here to teach principles, to teach Shiva, to teach Mithra, to teach the principles that the triple god religion. They came in ships up to 250 feet wide, which is what they claimed. There's some pictures of a ship in there. This was done by a naval architect, an Englishman who went to the temple at Brobadour, copied the design, and was sailing on the Indian Ocean. Well, those ships, you'll see a picture from a place called Carrizo Plain in California, and that's the same ships they used to use. It's a delta kind of masted, rig-hung, six-masted ship, 250 feet long. They had, it was basically kind of an outrigger. There's a picture of Casamalpais, a site where extensive burials were done in catacombs, not American Indian, Indian Indian. There's a Shiva there, a Kiva, Shiva, same thing. This is India, right. India, India. So we're seeing an incredible story that's unfolding as we really learn to understand the old stories, including the two pillars story of the Masons, which were the two stones, the one that would be destroyed not destroyed by water, one wouldn't be destroyed by fire. We're talking about dolomite, and they called it laterite. Well, that was a alluvial clay full of gold. So we had the gold and we had the silver side. These were the two. This was the triple conjunction. I mean, all of these symbols in ancient history, when you finally understand them, we will look right back, as I'm doing now, right back at these ancient people to see that the same truth, the same understanding of Ormus, which I call Umpas, I call them orbitally mirrored metallic primordial atoms, OMPA. That's what I believe they are. These are crystallogically, they're related, they're all face-center cubics. They're close packing, which means they get their orbitals together and they can bind to a binary form. And I just want to get all those thoughts out so this can be chewed on later. We can maybe go back and revisit this another time, and I can get more into details of these discoveries. But this is an ongoing 12-year program, 5 solid years in alchemy. This isn't really guesswork. I wish I could cover more of the ground on this and explain myself. But this is an extraordinary discovery, not because I or Carl or anybody else did this, but because it shows us who these people were, and it shows us what Stonehenge was, what they were doing there, and it ties the sacred geometry, as one gentleman mentioned, right back into this.
I really want to explore that, and before I do, let me just break in for a minute and say that we are having a triple conjunction in 16 hours with a full moon that's happening at 17 degrees in Sagittarius and Gemini, and there's a conjunction also of Jupiter, Chiron, and Neptune, which happens very, very, very rarely, and this full moon conjuncts in about 16 hours, which is 4 o'clock in the morning, our time tomorrow morning, and 11 in Pacific time on your time tomorrow, which is Sunday. And this is a particularly potent time for those of you who are going to be doing that. And so I just wanted to jump in when you were discussing astrology, and also to say that that I'd love to know about what you make of Stonehenge, and what from your understanding, what do people use that for?
Okay, well, Stonehenge is a ley line, a geodesic ley line. And like I mentioned, that ley line runs right through other famous spots. Basically, and I've been to Stonehenge, you know, and I've walked around and photographed it. And as far as I'm concerned, these areas in the world are areas where the alignment of the Earth's ecliptic, along with our Earth's plane, rather, our angle on the ecliptic, as well as the Moon's interactions and other planets, will we form essentially, I hate to use the word vortex, it's too simple a term, but basically it's a magnetic anomaly. It's a condition where Ormus, which is paramagnetic, will basically be moved. It'll interact with water. Now, we have done tests. And I personally have done this. I can verify that if you use a magnetic vortex, meow devices, I call them vortexes, you're creating a vortex or essentially almost an n-polar environment where you've got a magnetic field moving and electrons moving inside of this magnetite and forming essentially a pressure in every direction and a swirling moving pressure. It's ether drag, I think, that does this. And it causes an interaction. Well, we can take the elixir I've been making, for example, and you could separate it out and basically mix it back with water at about, 50-50, drop it in there and shake it up. Let it sit for about a week until it separates back out and the water comes back out. Take the water off and drink it, and it's as powerful as the Ormus itself. Now, how could that be? Well, the water's being charged. Now, if I take that same stuff out of the vortexer for up to 24 to 30 hours, there is no effect. It's void. So something's being put into the water. The purer the water, probably the better. We did a radionics test in Boulder. And a gentleman who's done radionics for probably, I don't know, this is one of Carl's friends, so maybe, 20, 25 years, Carl?
Yeah, he's been doing it for quite a while.
And he's good, real good. And he said that within 24 hours, most of the potency was gone, but it would really seriously affect its stickage when he would put this thing in there, charge it, and then sense it. There's a lot of indications that this is what Stonehenge was. They were using a metamorphic rock, which was basically, again, a Dominic limestone pressed together, ground together under pressure and heat with a an andesite, which is probably a pyroxene andesite, which means it's a type of the pyroxenes can have more calcium, they can have more I forget what the other one is, iron, I think, and they can have more magnesium. And depending on what they have, it's a different sort of rock, and this is usually high magnesium rock. Magnesium is the key. Magnesium forms a bipyramid in magnesium chloride in a hexahydrate form when it gets pretty much most of the water leaves. We see the same thing with magnetite. Magnetite forms a bipyramidal shape. There's a real key to the structure. And, you know, in chemistry, we know that you can have the same atomic, the same element, but the formation, the structure is different, and we get a different effect. It's an etheric phenomenon. It's dynamic. Stonehenge was where they went to celebrate, to use the blue stone, as they call it, or this dolerite, this spotted dolerite, and they used this to make an elixir. And they needed to predict the period of time when we would get a nice new moon, or basically it's particularly a lunar alignment. We'll see around the country these double, triple targets. The double target refers to a solar eclipse in some cases. And in other cases, it refers to a lunar eclipse. It's a phenomenon called the umbra and penumbra. And when the moon's right in the middle, it's slam bunk in the middle. Now, I have done tests with, as I broke this dolomite out, into the soma, into the emerita. And we did it on new moons. I tried to make sure the moon was right on the horizon, opposing the sun as far as, or in blocking it as far as possible, and under full moon conditions, it was opposing it. And we had a difference. I was processing this stuff with almost twice as much lime. The full moon, it was basically affecting nothing. You got a full effect. But if it was on the new moon, you lost a lot of the reaction. And the theory is that these menstruums, the green dragon particularly, these copper, silver, or mercurial, they align themselves under conditions where, I'll give you an analogy. You've got a flat pond, and you throw a rock out there at night still. There's no wind. And the ripples from that rock can be seen to travel nice and neatly across the pond. Well, try that during a windstorm. All the waves cancel one another out. There's just chaos. The chaos would be your full moon. The chaos would be normal conditions. The new moon will produce a condition like the still of a pond. And this is when the elixir vitae would be produced and a phosphor stone made. So astrology is critical if you're going to take this beyond the level of making simply hydroxide. The hydroxides are very, very healthy, but there's more to it. And Stonehenge was an example of predicting an area where they could predict these things and make the elixir from their blue stone. The blue stones were the first stones of Stonehenge, not the sarsen stones. And they were there a long time before the sarsen stones were erected. Nobody was sacrificing people on an altar stone. These people were healing people. They found people with buried nearby who had some very serious ailments. They didn't save them in time, and they died. They were coming there to be healed. And at sites around the world, including Teotihuacan, including these sites basically in some of our national cities here in America, as well as at Baalbek, as well as at the old, what people are calling Troy, which was a line, it was along the old trail into India from Greece. These sites were vortexes. And if you went there under the right conditions, not necessarily any time, but the right conditions, you could make the elixir and make it very powerful and you could be healed. That was the point, in my opinion.
Great. I loved when you said powerful and potent in relation to your own products. And I'd love for you to describe, because Barry's probably going to hit the number generator and tell the winners shortly. Tell us about the products you make and why you are calling them potent and powerful and how people will experience them and how you experience them, that you give them those terms.
Okay. Well, they're basically three products, if you will. One is the dolomite itself, because I feel it's extremely important to use that in straight form because of the calcium-magnesium balance. And it's very, very clean. It's a pure white dolomite. And it's been assayed. This is the cleanest it gets. We make the elixir out of it, which is going to be this soma or this emerita. And when you take it, you'll feel it within, it's like clockwork. Within about 3 minutes, most of us who are sensitive feel it in our system. By 7 minutes, you get a tightening of the forehead. You can feel your seventh chakra tingle, and it moves down your head and down your shoulders. And at about 25 minutes, it's gone into a nice warm feeling, and you just feel really energized. But it's interesting because you vortex this stuff. And much like, I have a lot of experience with psychedelic drugs when I was younger. And, you know, if you did 100 micrograms of LSD, 200 micrograms isn't twice as long or twice as strong. It's just stronger and a little longer. psychic compounds tend to work this way, that they're not just the sum total of doing it. It's kind of like the expansion of from a circle, a gravity or electrical field. It grows in some intensity and some duration. Well, when I take the vortex stuff, I'm getting effect that lasts up to an hour and 15, 20 minutes and is definitely more intense just from using the elixir in the vortexer and keeping it there 4 or 5 days. I just keep it filled. My vortexers are designed to do this. They have a 16-ounce bottle, and they give you 8 ounces of elixir. You mix it half with water, and you double it. Basically, my reason for doing this was I think that a lot of people with money and time can make warmth, but a lot of the people that need to be healed, need to be tuning their bodies, can't afford it. Old people with problems. We see rheumatoid arthritis be affected by this significantly. Things like fibromyalgia. A lot of these immune, rheumatoid arthritis isn't just arthritis, it's actually basically immune system problems as well. The immune system seems to really, really love magnesium. And so I say what we're doing here is we're mixing an elixir we take with a dolomite as a balanced source of these minerals, and you have to have calcium with magnesium. You can't mess around with your body that way. But you need a lot more magnesium than you're normally getting from calcium, because it won't break down, from dolomite, because it won't break down as well as you like. You get more of the calcium out of it and a lot less of the magnesium. So you augment that with we use Zextian oil, the purest magnesium chloride hexahydrate on the planet, and that, by the way, the sea it comes from, which is 2,000 meters down or so in Europe, across from Norway and Poland, almost all the way over to the British Isles. This stuff has been sitting here 250 million years, and it's absolutely pure. There's a few minerals in it, but it's so clean, and they're pumping it out. And it, you can buy it at other sources. It's called Zextian magnesium oil or Zextian magnesium chloride hexahydrate. And it's a wonderful way to get a transdermal magnesium dose that brings you up to where you should be. And you combine that with the elixir, and let's say it's like the wiring in your house. The wiring is affected, or the Ida Pingala Shishumna are cleaned by a good Ormus product. And then you've got your magnesium, like the electricity in the wire, and your calcium to do their electrical thing in the body. I mean, there are over 350 enzyme processes affected by magnesium. Many of the results people are seeing from making magnesium hydroxide from seawater is because of magnesium, partly. And we don't know which are Ormus, which are magnesium, but magnesium is a key to this. So the little chem pack, I call them chemi packs, they're a little sampler, and they come with 2 ounces of the elixir that I make, 2 ounces of the Zextian oil, and 4 ounces of dolomite, which is enough for a little over a month.
We're at a point where I want to announce the winners, and then we should
take great, but please do that after I hear about the oil.
Okay, I'll make it real quick. Look it up. It's a sea. It's an ocean that was really trapped after Pangaea. In fact, this is really important. I mentioned that impacts are directly related to Ormus. Now, I'm going to say it again because you need to want to hear this. If you don't have volcanic rock and you have that pressure, you don't have plate tectonic movement forcing things together from metamorphic rock, you need an impact to make the dolomite powerful. Normal dolomite, if you just made these things in a laboratory from atomics, wouldn't have any efficacy other than to be magnesium. But when you get dolomite that's been affected by impact collisions and the right pressure affects the stuff as it's being lithified, amazing things happen. The Zextian oil was this sea was on top of a copper shale. And it was deep down, and it was clean, but it was forming. It was actually being just covered up at the time that Australia, your home, Dennis, was whacked. This is back when Pangaea was a single landmass, but you were in the southern hemisphere. There was a really, really big rock. It made Chicxulub look small. It hit Australia, broke the continent off from the main part of Pangaea. That shock wave traveled right through the earth. It just shattered Siberia. This was called the Siberian Flats. It's like the basalt flood, and it's huge in Siberia. And right on that ring of you've got a solid earth core. So this thing ricochets like billiards. It leaves a hole in the middle where there's no impact, but it apparently makes it stronger on the ring where the pressure comes together. And so that area was right there where the Zextian Ocean was. Now it's underground. It's being pumped out of Norway by a really advanced mining technology. But this oil forms a hexahydrate. It's magnesium forming a double pyramid or a bipyramid with six water atoms, and holding these things, their hydrogens down, and forming a cage. We call it a clathrate cage. If you want to trap Ormus, you need a trap. I mean, you do it with magnets. The world of nature does it with magnesium. It traps it in a chlorophyll atom. It trapped it in a cage. It trapped it in a clathrate cage in magnesium oil. It trapped it in the carbonate structure, in the matrix of calcium, magnesium, carbonate, dolomite. There are a number of ways it can be trapped, but the problem is how you get it out. If you've got a dangerous stone, heavy metals, that kind of stuff, you can't process it because it would just be too much work to get the ormus out. So when you find something like dolomite, it's a clean, simple way to make it. You can make it at home. I mean, you got to be careful of what kind of acids you're using and make sure you take proper precautions. But it's not hard to make this. That's what people are doing when they're taking magnesium.
Dorian, why don't you give me an elevator speech on what your oil does to people and also what your protein does.
Dennis?
I want to
do an announcement of the winners. And
okay.
I would like to have time for one question from the pre-room before they're cut off. First, we want information on the winners. The winners are John in Australia, Margaret in Canada.
Are you saying Dawn or Don?
John, J-O-H-N.
Oh, John. Okay, cool.
And Margaret in Canada, and Michael in Washington State. And I'll send both of you the email information and other information that may be helpful for you to get in touch with them.
Yeah. And by the way, let me just put this plug in now, since we're about to go online. We've been. Like I say, or rather, see, there's a placeholder, a little site up. You can at least contact us by email. We're at Spagyric Arts. That's S-P-A-G-Y-R-I-C. Spagyric is plant alchemy, and that's arts, A-R-T-S. If you mistype it and say Spagyric Art, we are going to be pointing over that way from another site. But it's Spagyric, S-P-A-G-Y-R-I-C, arts, A-R-T-S.com. I'm Dorian today, and basically this is my company. My wife and I run this. We have a couple partners that are involved in this, and, of course, a number of great people that we have to thank. I mean, people like John Malewski's work and Meow Devices, Carl Ehrberger, who's been, relentless at pursuing these sites with me, and without his special eye, we wouldn't find a lot of things. There are a number of people that need thanks. This discovery is not just one person. We stand on the shoulders of giants, as Newton said. But just a little plug for the rest of the world, too. But SpagyricArts.com, and you can contact us. We can ship stuff to you for you. The website's fully up. You can call us, and we can arrange for this. We can tell you something about the product and that sort of thing. And they'll be up online. By the end of the week, it'll all be there, and you'll be able to see the products, and there'll be explanations of our work, and there'll be a link to another site which will give some of the data on these discoveries, which we'll put up over the next month. So just so you know.
Okay, great. Now, listen, we'd like to have a question or two from the free room before that gets cut off. So who's in the free room who's got a question for Dorian?
Well, I would like to say hi to Carl Lehrberger. This is Ted in Ashland. Carl, when are you coming this way again?
As soon as I can, but no later than the fall and no earlier than the solstice, the summer solstice.
Call me when you get here.
Who's this?
Okay, I want to give a little tidbit of information when you talked about the vortexes and when the moon aligns, when you can make the elixir of life. Every month you have a window that these vortexes open, where there's a power point, where there's a major ley line crossing with underground water. Those power points activate as a vortex from the sunrise of the full moon between 3 a.m. and 10 a.m., and some of them activate for several hours. And if you ever stood on one when it activates, and you're standing right on it at the exact point where it's going to activate, you will definitely feel an energy. You don't have to bring any instruments or anything. You just stand on it, and you know it's there.
Which is around about the time I collect my ocean water, by the way, around about 3 o'clock in the morning on a waxing full moon.
Yeah,
it's a powerful time.
Well, it's a real simple thing
it's on the sunrise of the full moon, and if you were to try to make the elixir of life, we're using a natural vortex, that's when it would actually activate every month, once a month, was on the sunrise of the full moon.
There's some wonderful, now what guy was looking for, the name of the alchemist that was teaching in Utah, I think it was Fractor Albertus, and he had a student who wrote a book on plant alchemy that was brilliant, and I'm looking in the library. I'm just not seeing it for the moment, but it's a book on working. Oh, here it is, right here. I found this very, very helpful for those of you who want to see an astrological connection and see how this works. He covers a lot of examples and shows you how to utilize that. It's called Real Alchemy, A Primer of Practical Alchemy, and it was by Robert Allen Bartlett, B-A-R-T-L-E-T-T, and he was a student of Albertus. And just brilliant book. I mean, it's just a nice, short treatise on etheric art.
Bartlett's books are very good. I have, yes.
This is Susanna. Robert Allen Bartlett will be speaking at the Alchemy Conference coming up in October. He was also a presenter and speaker at the Alchemy Conference in Las Vegas last October. Very humble, quiet fellow, very knowledgeable.
Excellent.
Did you go to that one, this last event I had?
Yes.
Event?
Yes, I went and met a lot of great people there, and Dana was there as well, and to go this year, and he's going to be speaking again. And he talked about Frater Albertus, a whole lot of stories. It was interesting.
Yeah, I believe he came out of the Rosicrucian school, but wasn't really directly associated, I think. But these people, Frater Albertus and his students, they seem to have a really good handle on the alchemy side, and this is what Egyptians knew. Anybody who really wants to see how deep this goes, you might consider reading a wonderful book by one of the great geniuses in polymath of the 20th century. His name was R.A. Schwaller de Lubeck. And many of his books are great. Esoterism and Symbol is a classic. But by reading Sacred Science, I have found more in that book than almost anywhere. A brilliant, brilliant work. And Cross, you know, it's pollinated by every field of esotericism. If anybody's interested in seeing what the Egyptians knew about alchemy and astrology, it's a great way to start.
How do you spell that name?
S-C-H-W-A-L-L-E-R, I believe.
Yes, R-A. R-A is usually the initials. R-A. Waller, like he said, S-C-H.
W-A-L-L-E-R.
Barry, could you post it to the Ormond site so everyone can get it?
It's already on my website in...
Yeah, but could you post it online to the Ormond's forums, please?
Sure.
Yeah, it's a great read. Everybody should read that. This man was so brilliant that the archaeologists of his day didn't know what to do with him. They just pretty much had to ignore him because he was a coherent. His science was coherent. It was well thought out, and he really deduced what the Egyptians were all about. And this is they were key alchemists, and they kept the traditions and they kept the knowledge alive because nobody could figure out what they were saying. So they couldn't butcher it, you know. They put it in stone. They made it permanent.
I'm sorry. The free room was just terminated.
So anyone else got any questions before Dorian starts at his manic, helter-skelter pace of delivering his material? Okay, while you're taking a moment to think about it, I just want to take the first International Ormus Conference on the 5th, 6th, and 7th of September in Georgia. And listen, I'd love you to say a little bit about it, Thomas. Give us a microscopic speech about it. Tell us what's going on.
Who have confirmed. It's at Anota, which is a really beautiful, unspoiled spot in North Georgia. And I've posted the list, but John Maluski has confirmed as well. I'm waiting to hear a lot of noise there.
Sounds like a airplane truck.
We're waiting to hear back from Farrell Brenner, but David Wolf is speaking, and Barry, and Melanie Proctor is coming. And I'm, Tom Waters and Charles Dragoo, and the MC, the Master of Ceremonies, is none other than Dennis Cooney from...
watch out for that guy!
Oh, yeah, he's here. He's like from outer space. And, aren't we all? Gosh, there's so many. I can't even recite them all. It should be quite neat.
What's the cost of the program? How long does it go for?
The program itself, just the Orms event, is $99. But in addition to that, there's whatever lodging people choose, which ranges from campsites up to cabins. There's motels nearby as well as motel rooms on the spot. There's food available, which would be in addition. and certain workshops. I'm going to have a trap building workshop, and that won't be for $99. That won't be included. There'll be other workshops and demos, mostly on Monday. The bulk of the talks will be done on Saturday and Sunday.
Excellent.
We have an invitation out to none other than David Hudson, and we have not heard a word back, but there is an invitation out, and I know it has been delivered.
Very good.
Well, so that being said, it's an opportunity for everybody to come and network. I think the opportunity is to be able to sit down at lunch with somebody that you hear on these conference calls and be able to pick their brain and ask the questions without, without having all the beeps and the talks and all that sort of stuff, where people will be accessible for a couple of days. And I think it'll be an extraordinary event. We're going to have drumming circles and sweat lodges, and there's a 3-acre organic, USDA certified organic farm, which has been ormicized with Dead Sea salt precipitate. That I've made over the full moons over the last several months, including the Weestack moon last month, and it should be wonderful produce and a wonderful company. So there, I don't want to hog Dorian's call.
Great.
Well, that was our commercial break. So Dorian, where do you want to go next? I know you've got so much information to tell us.
Well, I think I want to leave you at least with this thought. And this is, again, coming from my personal experience. And I'm a person who's had...
We're not finishing for a while yet.
Okay, well, here's
we have
my...
another half an hour.
I want to emphasize this. And basically, I was sad to hear somebody kind of take a negative stand on Ormus or anything. I think that I know it was not on Ormus per se, but on the abuse. I think that anything can be abused. I think that there are probably two kinds of people on the extremes who use these chemicals. One will be people who are trying to gain spiritual enlightenment and are seeking for spending their lives in order to do more on this planet. There are those who might seek it because it's a good buzz. And I think that we need to focus on the fact that anciently much of this technology was considered sacred science. And it was not shared with most people because the people who knew it recognized that with any high science, with any truth, comes responsibility. And I think that we as an Ormus community, and I speak just as an individual within that community, not as the community, but that we need to understand the purpose of the Tree of Life. It's not for entertainment. It was to progress. If we could live 5-10 times longer, we could certainly accomplish more good or bad. The Tree of Life was kept, the old story, whether it be a metaphor or not, Adam and Eve, or let's say any Adam and Eve, and there are probably many, either learn to listen to the universe, speak to them, listen to God, listen to their own conscience, and try to perfect their lives. And Ormus, in that case, gives us insights. It helps us to live longer. I mean, we should be able to live at least 120 to 30 years just using the Green Dragon Elixir alone. And this would give us a chance to perfect our lives, to overcome our weaknesses. I think that's really the point. This is a spiritual journey. The great work of alchemy was not just about making Ormus. It wasn't about making gold. It was about purifying the soul. And we need to think about that. I'm not sure most people probably in your forums are well aware of this, but I think it needs to be considered. This is where the irresponsibility comes in. And we could choose instead to have a great time, party on, and talk about how it gives us a buzz. But I think the important thing is what we do with our time here. But just a little plug for maybe the old esoteric wisdom about using this for the right reason.
So my point of view, you use it for any reason, it'll upgrade you.
You said upgrade you?
You use almost for any reason, it will upgrade you. Doesn't matter what your motivation is, almost will tend to upgrade every aspect of your life, including the reasons you even take it, including what you do with it, including the consciousness you come from, including the love and happiness and joy that happens in your life, including every aspect that's possible to aspire to in life almost seems to enhance. Matters why you start.
So I'd like to use a little phrase we used to use back in the days of psychedelia, and that was that you can give a person LSD and you can change the way they think, but you can't stop them from thinking about what they're going to choose to think about. We can certainly enhance our lives. I haven't been sick in 2 years, or 2.5 years. I don't get sick. This is a wonderful thing. I mean, if I catch a flu, it's just very slightly and it goes away, and I don't get any bacterial. So we've seen, in fact, that this stuff, when it first affects, we've seen cholesterol drop to the floor with people doing this. And this is also probably magnesium. I mean, bear in mind that magnesium is really critical. And you asked about the zeaxanthin oil. I can't tell you enough. Magnesium is the key to much of our health. It's 350 enzyme processes require it, including, you know, when you're dividing cells, much of the healing we see from Ormus, particularly with magnesium hydroxide bases, we might be seeing the effect of magnesium because it really helps the mitosis, meiosis. It helps to, you know, if you look at a healthy cell with magnesium, it has long telurons, these long threads that's dividing and going through mitosis, meiosis. If you have a deficiency of magnesium, they're broken. The cells can't be healthy. You'll find that cancer cells form in areas of a lower pH where you're not enough basic blood. Yeah, if your fluids aren't basic. And also, if you can't get the toxic metals out, magnesium and calcium carry these out of your body. So it's really important to think of this as a balanced routine of not just Ormus, but the right minerals. Just a plug for holistic healing here.
Dorian?
Yes.
I wanted to ask, there have been some people that I know who take the Ormus products, and they never, ever hear the Hue sound.
Well, if you take mine...
opinions about that?
Well, a lot of it's it's in biology. I mean, we have some people who have much higher DMT levels. You know, most people who are depressed, these are such complex... You know, I spent a lot of time studying neurophysiology, and I think we can trace a lot of this back to the way our brains work. I mean, some of us are very left-brained because we're literally living in that part of the brain. Others of us become more intuitive. I mean, a study at the University of Utah about 6 months, 8 months ago was very interesting. It showed that even over the last 4,000, in the case of some Englishmen, about 2,000 years, their brains have shrunk. Now, you've got a bigger forebrain, but the back brain, the lizard brain, the primitive brain that's intuitive, it's shrinking. We're destroying our intuition by relying on machinery and relying on daily schedules and all the things we do, you know, as Western society. We need time for meditation and yoga. I mean, the Amrita elixir, Soma, the stuff I sell and anybody can make from a proper dolomite, is literally the basis for Buddhism. I mean, take a look at a stupa. A stupa is the sacred geometry of the perfect cube, the perfect sphere, and a triangle and if you look at these and measure them, they're at 23.5 degrees. And on the top is a kalasa, which is, in fact, kalasa becomes Rahu, the same image over the temple doors, which is if you know the story of the Sea of Milk in different variations, there's always somebody who's not supposed to have the elixir, and he gets it, and he starts to drink it, and Shiva or an avatar, or I should say a Vishnu or an avatar, cuts off his head, but the head stays immortal, and it swallows the moon during eclipses. Well, it was a part of the story embedding the need for astrology and all this. But the point is that if you look at Buddhism, you look at a stupa, and you look at Buddhism, the tradition, the Amrita is supposed to come off the roof of your mouth, or basically right beneath the pineal gland, and drop down to the body. And this is the symbol of the stupa, the top kalasa, which is really nothing less than a crescent moon and a circle in the middle, being a conjunction symbol. And this is supposed to be a vessel to hold Amrita, and it drips down into the body. When you do the silver, copper, Ormus, like the stuff we have, you'll feel it right in your, basically directly in your brow, which is where you feel, when you study yoga, you find that you'll feel the tightening of the brow if you have Amrita. Well, it's quite literal. And you feel it tightening up, and you feel this tingle, and down it goes. It's classic yoga, liquid yoga. I mean, I don't know what else to call it. And it was the basis for these religions. I don't care if it's Vedic Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism. The Amrita was a key. And so, you know, what we're seeing...
It's also known as nectar.
Yeah, it was also called the nectar of immortality, would be the direct translation from the Sanskrit. Also, the word soma and the word amrita are the same. Our product is called Amrita Soma for that reason. It's the same chemistry. Amrita Soma, nectar of immortality, the elixir of life, these are the dancing waters. If you process this from dolomite, you'll see what people, I think, are usually calling Ormus oil will often be a chloride in a very concentrated form that will float on top of the aqueous solution you've processed when you've digested your stone, or if you're working with other materials. But you'll see this oil. Well, this is really, if you test it, you'll find it's a chloride. In fact, when we first processed this, when we had trouble getting the salt out at first, we had electrostatic charges coming off this stuff that was shocking. In fact, Barry was there. I gave him a bottle of the early stuff, a little bit saltier, and so it held the charge better. Barry, why don't you tell them what happened when you opened that thing?
Well, as happens fairly commonly, but not all the time, when I opened it, a shock came out. You know?
And more than one, usually more than one, it hurts.
Yeah.
Well, we developed that much charge in a bottle by pouring this down no more than about 8 inches of Nalgene plastic through a tube. I mean, that was it. I mean, you have to run, you know, a petroleum product through a lot of meters of plastic to get a charge. This stuff was just dropping a few inches and causing that problem. We had trouble bottling it. We finally got most of the salt out of it, and it was really helpful because now it doesn't destroy you when you open it up. But these are big sparks. They would keep going. It's like that spark water that's sold. That kind of thing.
Like
it's sparking, so discharge. Yeah. It was quite remarkable. But the dolomite, by the way, this particular dolomite, I can tell you this. I'm not going to tell you where it comes from, but it's all over the Great Basin. But this sort of dolomite is what's moving across it's a dark version of this dolomite. It's not something you want to eat. But this dolomite is so powerful. This is part of this California Great Basin phenomenon. This in these impact zones. And if you look at the famous valley called the Racetrack, where these rocks move on their own, if you go out there, they won't let you there during a lightning storm. There's a reason. Nobody wants you to know. I think this is a part of the cover-up. But if you watch them, the mud gets slick. The electrical potential is so high underneath some of these thunderheads. We were up there filming one night up there, not in the valley, in the racetrack, but right across from it. And the lightning is violent. And when these charges become so different between ground and the air, there's a huge differential. That's when these rocks, the Meissner levitation, they'll levitate and move across the valley. It answers the question of how these rocks move up there. They only move during lightning storms. This is what happens when you have a high ormus content or umpa content in something like dolomite. It's so intense that it will literally cause these stones to lighten up enough that it will, with the electrical current and the winds and other phenomena, it will blow it, move across the valley. This is my theory. It's probably why you're not allowed up there during lightning storms, because superconductivity is still considered kind of a military application. And, you know, there are people who don't want you digging in this area. So, but anyway, this is, you know, dolomite can be very powerful. I won't mention the developer. There's a man who makes Ormus, and it's in the Washington area, and he knows the dolomite up here that's very strong. So you might look at these sources. The Great Orm is an example. You've got a huge amount of dolomite covering most of the central part, eastern part of the United States, in the Appalachia down through Kansas. There are areas in Kansas where there are petroglyphs, and this dolomite, this Dominic limestone, is being processed by hot water in the hydrothermal vents coming up through the ground. They dug that sandstone out and processed it. I won't go into this now, but I'll just say that you'll find the same phenomenon in Anza Borrego. In the desert, there's a fault line. It runs all the way down for thousands of miles, and if you can find that fault line, it's rich in ormus, and they did. And they dug yonis, which are female vulva symbols in the rock to celebrate the fertility of this. And in fact, I'm going to leave you with one last story, which I think anybody who hears this will get a real kick out of this. Most of you have heard of Coca-Pelli. Well, there's a new theory that I put together of who Coca-Pelli is, and I proved this pretty much by going into the desert back where the Indians were coming in, back near Capamolpais, which is in eastern Arizona. And there's a site there, and it's private land now. I couldn't get into it, but I've got a good shot to this. And this is the real Coca-Pelli. He wasn't blowing a flute. If you look at what Coca-Pelli carries in the early Coca-Pelli, this is the so-called dancing Indian with a flute. That's not a flute. It's called a blowpipe. It's typical of miners. You still see them using exactly that same shape, which is a clay blowpipe with a slightly extended end to help spread the air over the coals. To blow air over a coal, you put your ore on top, and out comes the metal ore. Whatever's in there will melt out under high heat when a coal is being blown by a blowpipe. If you look at Coca-Pelli, there's several clues to who he is. In the oldest versions, he doesn't just have a hunchback, he has a hemispherical back. This means he's from the other side of the earth, the other hemisphere. If you look at the old meridian line in India, near city-state areas like Mojandaro, they had a meridian, which wasn't Greenwich, England like we have now. It was over there in the Indus Valley. If you look directly across the planet, it's the Great Basin. This was the underworld. The Mayans knew this. In fact, the churning of the Sea of Milk story comes up again as the Mayans claim they came following the snake or the Nagas or the Magi that came through the stars from the other side of the world. They came down to Central America from India. They came across to the underworld. They always talked about Lanka being in sunlight when it was darkness in India. This is America. They knew about this place. They came here by the currents. And every story, if you go back, ties into the turtles, which is the symbol of the hemisphere again, them coming and swimming the currents, traveling the currents of the world. There's a map in my set of pictures. It's the first time I've released this map. It shows the path of the Magi in the Pacific as best as I can track them. This is some of the most esoteric places on Earth. You'll find the symbols of these people everywhere in the location if you look at that map. So this is a big story. Cocopelli was a miner. His limp was a standard labyrinth, you know, the lame smith story, the smithing going back to Ormus again, back to Umpas, back to these Quintessentia. He's limping, in other words, dancing through the labyrinth, through consciousness, to be able to learn how to ascend, to control his ascent and descent and his life, his incarnation. And he has a humpback because he's from the other side of the world, and he blows in a blowpipe. And he was also linked with fertility. I think that you'll find that particularly the copper and silver Ormus materials will beef up fertility quite a bit. And it's also magnesium does this. I mean, magnesium plays a huge role in this, so there's a real link in there to the dolomite once again. But every symbol, the Cocopelli, is not a, you know, a dancing Indian with a flute. That's what Carl Ehrberger mentioned about some of these myths becoming distorted and lost through time. My belief is that that is the miner. It's the same story as the Pied Piper of Hamel. Same idea that you've got miners that travel around who know how to use the Ormus, and it becomes very good. People want it for fertility, for health, and to be able to have children in their old age. Saraya, Abraham, a Brahmin from India, same story. So the Cocopelli is a whole new take on this. This is an ancient symbol of the Indian miners that came in here. And it's in fact, we've got a spot out there near the borders of Arizona and New Mexico where the Cocopelli is blowing directly with a twin pipe. He doesn't just have a single pipe. It breaks into two for the red and green dragon, and he's blowing on a prima materia quintessence cross. You couldn't be more bold than that. So these symbols are everywhere.
You know, one of the things that you see as you rattle off a whole bunch of these different power places was Greenwich, and I've never understood why Greenwich was a special spot. What do you know about it?
Absolutely nothing. I will tell you one thing about the English, though. Look at these ley lines. Look at geodesy. And I think this came out particularly in a wonderful book about later people, in this case the Knights Templar, who coded Europe with the cathedral. And they knew about America. They were coming here, and they were leaving behind codes, how to get here. They were telling you. And in the book, these are mathematicians and a videographer who was doing this great book on the Bornholm Mystery. It's an island off of Denmark, and it's a wonderful place. There's over 25 old circle square, which is the sacred geometry church is built on there, with alignment sometimes between these are so accurate, almost a laser couldn't do it. They must have had incredible optics back in the 12th and 13th centuries, 12th century. But anyway, the Knights Templar knew about this stuff, and in this book they discuss the fact that the English measurement system, particularly the mile and also the rod, but these measurements were so accurate that when the French were able to determine the circumference, polar circumference of the Earth, and use the meter, that the accuracy was only half that of the English system, which had been around since 5,000 years ago. In other words, the people that were measuring...
The nautical miles is the division point of
the degrees and minutes and seconds that... That is how we determine latitude and longitude. It's all expressed in nautical miles, and this has basically been hidden from us.
Well, and that's also that there's nautical, but there's also statute miles. But I think that you look at the rod system, and the rods were they probably used a very, very accurate system for measuring the circumpolar circumference. You know, if you measure the equator, obviously you get a distortion because the Earth bulges. You want to measure the north-south. And it was so accurate, like I said, it's twice as accurate as the meter. And this is so old. I mean, if you look at Ireland, Ireland's a great place. If you want to see the impact of the old Anunnaki giants, they were called the Fomorians back then, and the Indo-Europeans who were associated with them from, they worked with them for years. You'll find all the old histories of Gilgamesh, it's all human beings working with the giant. And they were both living together somewhat in peace in Ireland before the Danann tribes came in with what looks like steam engines and motored in there around 2200 BC and took it over, and the giants left. Where did the giants go? They went under... ground? No, they went under the world. They went under the water to the other side of the world. In fact, they went to the Lochland, the land of lakes. Look at America. Look at the Great Lakes, Wisconsin, Minnesota, all the way through northeastern Canada. This is where they went. The mining operations, they were around 1,500 years. They were drilling copper, very, very rich silver copper, isotopically identical to what we see in Europe in the bronzes in the Roman Empire. It all came from there through Glastonbury. You've got connections into England and Glastonbury and the church there. This goes on and on. I mean, everybody knew about this place who was esoteric. And as somebody mentioned, kings and queens knew about it? Yeah, I think so. In fact, Carl Lehrberger might want to mention some of the work he's done. He's been down to Tucson, a place called Silverbell, which was an old Roman. The Romans came in with some esoteric Hebrews and mined that area from about 750 to 900. This is in Tucson, Arizona, just to the west, east side of Tucson. And there are a bunch of other spots. He's working at a spot now down there that's similar to this. It may have been, you know, the Aztecs and maybe later Spanish coming in. But we see Hidden Mountain down there near Albuquerque. This place was, it's got the famous Decalogue, the Ten Commandment stones. The Hebrews were there probably around 150 B.C. I mean, people were coming and coming, but it was people that knew the secret, knew navigation, had boats, and who came here mostly for Ormiston to teach the people of America the truth, the true nature of God, a cosmological religion. We had 96 languages in America in the 60s, Native American languages, but only one single religion of the Great Spirit. How did that come about? Something to ask yourself. Anyway, it's kind of a long spiel with lots of data in it, but maybe Carl can tell you a little bit about these sites. I mean, the wonderful crosses down in Tucson. Is he still with us?
Yeah. Are you talking, Dorian, about the alchemetic symbols?
Well, and the Rosicrucian crosses, all the 32 or 33 artifacts there at the University of Tucson's museum, in particular.
And the connection to a Roman Hebrew colony in the New World in the Tucson area that was replete with a lot of Hebrew symbols, as well as Roman and Latin, describing the existence of this early city that was eventually wiped out by the Indians, that was part of the warring history between the settlers from Rome and the Indians, and it's all recorded, and prominent imagery of the artifacts, which are swords and also plates, are crosses, and very, very elaborate crosses with snakes going through them. Again, combining imagery of late Jewish and early Christianity groups. So the history of America is replete with all sorts of different crosses that appear from different peoples, and it's an exciting field to be in as you go out and really try to gauge these. The cross is a symbol for alchemy, but as it becomes something else for other people.
Well, the fact that it has the snake, the serpent, winding up the cross, there's another. The serpent was always the symbol of wisdom in esotericism. It was the symbol of the hue sound. It was linked to consciousness, just as it was the serpent coming out of the head of the Sphinx and out of Pharaoh's head, linked back to the pineal gland. And maybe this is a point that should be made. There were always two sacraments in the ancient religion. The two sacraments were, one was a psychedelic sacrament. There can be no doubt. There's too much evidence pointing to this. And the other was the Ormus. Most people that are doing the Ormus don't understand the other side of this, that without consciousness, what good is long life? And without long life, you know, that one, what's consciousness, if you die too young, that you can't learn the lessons and be able to, hopefully, never die. I mean, there are stories of those who are translated. Go to the Bon Po tradition. You'll see it in the Bible. You'll see it called translation. I'm a Mormon, and in the Mormon church, there's a lot of talk about that in the Book of Mormon. There are a number of people who apparently were using the elixirs and managed to not die. They literally began to extend their lives to the point where, we don't know, they don't seem to have had a lifespan that we could consider in terms of normal years. I mean, look at the Enoch story, which took place in America. This was in the old Lanka, the old Atlantis. This whole culture were translated. So I think that there's a huge potential with Ormus, once we understand these chemistries in our own bodies, to extend life, and hopefully we extend life and consciousness, and both mature and evolve together. Without one, the other is pointless. I mean, this is why the two trees in the old story, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the story of the tree of life, were never separated in the old story. They weren't just metaphors. Just something to bear in mind.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Have you gentlemen read America B.C. by Barry Fell?
Yeah. Many of us cut our teeth on that one, particularly Carl.
Oh, okay, I just wanted to check.
Yeah. A lot of the work in Colorado, Carl will tell you, he was out there for years looking at the Ogham, the Celtic writings. You know, Carl, why don't you mention Cave and kind of how we got together over there, the comment I made and what you guys were doing out there, how that kind of ties, if you don't mind.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say thank you for including me in your conference call, Dorian and Barry. And I'm going to have to sign off after this.
But what Dorian's referring to is a site in Oklahoma that is a series of sandstone caves, and carved in the five caves are all sorts of Mithraic or European sun cult inscriptions that tell the story of the old world sun god, and also have the different goddesses as well, the goddess of the hunt and the Sheila Nagig, and all these imagery are recorded in the stone out there. But what's so fantastic about it, like the site that Dorian was talking about in California that has many, many, many alignments, Anubis Cave has probably at least a half a dozen, but all but one occur at the equinox. However, that is to say that there's a solar animations out there that take place in the context of a mythology that you see play out on the equinox. And that's where I met Dorian in the field, which was really part of the Barry Fell story that was earlier mentioned, because the people that really know most about Anubis Cave were the next generation from Barry Fell that pursued the Celts and Old World Ogham, which is inscribed in much of Oklahoma and Kansas and Colorado, often in a relation with archaeoastronomy events, most notably around the equinox, but also other times of year. So it was a really fitting place to meet Dorian and initiate a really amazing relationship that's taken us throughout the Great Basin, California, and really all over the Great Basin, exploring these sites, particularly around times of equinox and cross-quarter days, but in most recently following Dorian's discoveries with the ancient alchemy codes that are found in the early petroglyphs we found. So again, thank you for including me, and I hope I made a little contribution to the conference.
Well, thanks, Mahal. You made a great contribution. Thank you. I learned something from you, and it was very valuable. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Talk to you soon, Carl.
Okay. Thanks again, Dorian. Bye.
Dorian?
Uh-huh.
I was wondering, somebody had told me that there's ancient caves in the Grand Canyon that the government won't let you see that are filled with Egyptian artifacts.
Yeah, that's a story that's been around and retold many times. It's probably true. I mean, we've seen enough indications of cover-ups. I mean, I don't get into the conspiracy side much. There's no point in discussing what is probably true and which we can't do much about. But if you want to see the culprit, go to the Smithsonian. These people have worked. We know of at least one case recently in New Mexico where giant bones washed out of an arroyo in a national park during a heavy rainstorm. And in came the FBI and the Smithsonian. They've made people sign documents. They wouldn't talk, and they'd go to jail. I mean, they've been covering up the truth about our history, and to some degree the truth of Ormus, because you know, these people, the giants, were using it. And I wanted to make a comment. I almost forgot this. I say that cave is probably legitimate. We don't know. I can't say either way. But there are many places. There are old stories among the Paiute of people coming with boats, rowing up. You know, the old Great Basin used to be huge lakes, Lake Lahontan and Lake Bonneville. The name Bonneville Dam might ring a bell if you know about that. These are areas where there was once part of the old Pacific Ocean. And eventually it gets cut off, and these are areas people sailed into. And there are many stories about the Paiute had stories about these people that were tall and coming in with these big boats, and they would go underground into caves. In the Death Valley, what's now Death Valley, which of course we think of as a huge desert, but it was a lot wetter then. So around the country, we've seen burial grounds of giants, and very often they're directly associated with these Ormus compounds. Carl didn't stay long enough to mention that the connection with Anubis was very sketchy. People don't know why they were these Celtic speaking. What I'm thinking of, Ogham encoding people who, by the way, were using symbols of Mithra combined with symbols of Anubis. What was going on there? And they've got Mithra coming out of a cube. These are all the same story, whether it's the sword in the stone, in the Glastonbury story of King Arthur. His son came over here and brought the Glastonbury church here in 570. They settled in Tennessee, Kentucky. There were still Welsh-speaking Indians down there when the first settlers came in. Whether we're talking about Quetzalcoatl, who comes is born with a stone with a sword in his hand, whether we're talking about Enki, whose early symbols in Mesopotamia clearly show him standing between two streams, two water paths or currents in the ocean. that he would come and teach America, whether we're talking about Mithra, who has a sword and a stone. He comes out of a cubic stone. All of these stories, the cube refers to the earth or the ether, both, and the sword refers to people learning the truth and being held accountable. You know, Christ's old story about I don't come to bring peace, I come with a sword. These stories are part of esoteric history. And whether there are people there in the Grand Canyon caves or not, we don't know, but they certainly were here. If you want to see the equivalent to that, there's a place open to the public in near Springerville, Arizona, which is down in the south, the east corner of Arizona. It's way out in the middle of nowhere, about 6,000 feet up. It's an old volcanic, basalt volcano. And you'll find there were holes. We went up there and measured this. We found more alignment. They're marked with the symbol of the sheep. The sheep symbol, the horns of the sheep, is an alchemical symbol for calcination, which means they were burning rock. In this site, they were harvesting the basalt, again, a high pyroxene, rich high magnesium rock. They buried their dead in catacombs. There's at least eight acres of catacombs. The Indians didn't do that. This wasn't Native American. And there's also a kiva there. Well, substitute kiva for chiva, and you've got it, because out of Mumbai, there's a cave with a huge Shiva Linga, and they would go in and worship. It's the same thing. They're worshiping the Shiva Linga, and you'll find there's caves down there. The government won't let you in, by the way, to get to the catacombs. You have to have special permission. But there are underground caves there where these ancient people used to probably do work for the dead. The old, this was done in Christianity, baptisms for the dead. There was work being done on behalf of the dead, probably, at these locations. And Ormish youth, all the alignments, the cross quarter days, solstices, and this is all part of alchemy. That you can't separate old world history from alchemy. If there's esoterics involved, it always goes back to the Ormus processing, to the astrological alignments, and the religious holidays which occurred during these new moons. That was the big time. They had others too, but the lunar calendar was the religious calendar, the solar calendar was the secular calendar, and the two met in lunisolar intercalated years. But it was always figured on the moon. This was the religious ceremonies because of the Ormus or the M state elixir, the I call them umpas, the orbitally mirrored metallic primordial atoms. It's a mouthful, but I think it's the best description I can come up with. But this story goes on and on, and if there are caves there in the Grand Canyon and you got to go in them, you'd find the same story. You'd find the same sorts of symbols. The beauty of this is we can go back. I can go back 24,000 years as a wonderful stone piece carved out of Dolomitic limestone with a pregnant fetish woman on the front holding her left hand over her tummy. She's pregnant. She's fertile, in other words. And in her right hand is a bison horn. They used to use the horns of animals, particularly the red deer and others. In fact, it's a hart's horn. They used to use this horn. They would grind it up, put it in with sodium chloride, burn it to get salmoniac. From the salmoniac, they could process the elixir. And here's this horn with the 13 marks on it, which meant the 13 lunar months, or the 13-degree angle of the moon that moves across the sky, or that they used to count the long equinox. They actually used 13 periods for a 26,000-year procession. It's all there on a single image in a cave in southern France, dating back 24,000 years. Were they using Ormus? You bet they were. And everywhere we go, we find this. And one thing I didn't mention, which I think was so fascinating, I didn't cover this, but I'll just drop the ball now. Maybe we can pick it up later. Think about these people that came and traveled around the world. They carried cauldrons with them. You'll see pictures on the images I sent of cauldron sheets. These are cauldrons. They were known for it, and the Indians were amazed here that they were carrying these metal things around. But when they couldn't work with a cauldron, how would you do processing? Well, this is called cup and ring, and particularly cup and groove. They would grind cupules into the rock. Often they were processing the very same rock and eating it. They would grind it in that rock, and they would decant off the surface water down grooves into the next cup to leave a distillate, or they'd take the water off and use that for the next process. In other words, these petroglyphs, these cup and groove marks, in my opinion, are literally alchemical vessels for the processing of the elixir of immortality right on the rock around the world. India's got them everywhere. Of course, they were doing it forever down there. But America's got them, Great Basin, they're all over the place. And of course, in Ireland, in northern Scotland, the Viking areas, wherever they were, they processed the rock this way, and they actually made alchemical laboratories out of the stone faces themselves. It's an incredible theory, but it seems to bear out. Look at these sites. You'll see it. They were doing it.
Well, thank you, buddy. Listen, we're out of time. That was an amazing download of information. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah, sorry it goes so fast. There's just an awful lot of it.
Now, Dorian, will you also send a link to Barry of your site and other sites that are of interest so Barry can post them to all the Ormus groups?
Yeah, I'll have my wife send out immediately. The link again is Bajiric Arts. com, but I'll have Kathy send a link to Barry, and he can post it. And enjoy those images. If you have questions, you can always email me. I may not be able to get back to it right away, but I'll try to answer the question. We'll leave those up. If we do this again, I can cover maybe more detail into some of these. There's an awful lot I covered. There's, you know, one topic could last for a long time, and they're all interlinked back to Ormus, so maybe we can do it again.
Great.
Yes.
Okay. Much better.
Like it.
Hello?
So listen, we'll wind up now and say goodbye before you go.
Goodbye to everybody, and I hope that there was something there that everybody could benefit from.
Yes, for one question?
Yeah.
Go.
What was, when you said you had mentioned the best dolomite site there was right now?
Oh, okay. Well, one of them I'll mention just because it's something you could actually do some research on. There are sites all around the world, and we've discovered many of them, but the one I mentioned is called the Great Orme, G-R-E-A-T, like great, like big, Orme, O-R-M-E, literally like Orme. And it's in Western Wales, and this was a site, if you go and research, you'll see there were copules, they were grinding the stone and eating it. They also mined copper there. They eventually got very interested in the copper itself, so they were in there doing both. But this is a good example of an Orme or a M-State, Ormus, Umpa site that was used extensively by Vikings and early people from the north, and we assume that some of the people in Wales, I'm not sure, but it was used extensively and drilled. They literally drilled through this mountain, and it was known, again, the word Great Orme. Orme in, I think it's the, well, I can't say which country it is, but in the ancient Viking tongue, the Orme meant serpent. So there's a direct link, again, back to the Hugh sound. So you get this over and over again. There's always a connection, but the fact that it's called the Orme is, I find it's not just kind of coincidental. I think it's maybe very telling of how these things come around and go around, you know?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, I have one question, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Oh, this is Charles Jogu, by the way, from Greenville, South Carolina. Question is, with these discoveries, have you ever tried to produce this Ormus from the dolomite using crude materials like the ancients did?
I haven't because, I mean, I know it can be done. It's just going to be a lot more time process intensive. What I haven't covered here, and I don't have time to go into it, is that there was a coating done. I could show you these ancient images of Pashupati, but I'll hold it off for another time. But you can tell what they were doing because they literally coated it into these images, into the shapes. And they were using salmoniac, and we don't know whether they're using hydrochloric or not from their writings, because they didn't leave any writings. They're esoteric people. They hid it. But I'll tell you what we do know. At sites throughout the Great Basin, the symbols are clearly there for three things. One is vitriol. If you look at the pictures I put on the site from Surprise Tank, you'll see it, one of them is labeled vitriol. I hope the label came through. But that's a symbol which is kind of like the prima materia. It's like a downward-facing it's like a crossbar of a cross and a downward stroke with balls in the end of each one. That is the symbol for sulfuric acid. We have the symbol for nitre or nitric acid on the rocks. Now, some of these sites are 1,500, 2,500, maybe 3,000 BC, and they're using it. So Geber did not invent, nitric acid. He did not invent hydrochloric acid. These things were known about by these same people who, I mean, if you'd been to the sites I've been at, I was with a professional petrologist, a really sharp guy, and we went to a number of sites for I mentioned metamorphic stone. And I'll just say this. These sites, the petrology there was so precise, the liquid state mineralogy was so well understood, that they were able to find a 2-inch thick rind on a rock that they only carved out around a particular mineral in a certain shape to get exactly the right ormus out of there. I mean, this is stuff that you'd have to be a top-notch geologist, petrologist to know what you're doing. And we're talking about sites that go back perhaps 7,000 BC. So, you know, anybody who thinks that these ancient people were hairy, running around, dragging their knuckles from the ground, it's just ridiculous. They had, some of them at least, had a very extensive knowledge, sophisticated knowledge of mineralogy. And they didn't have these acids. They definitely did. Whether they carried them with them, it wouldn't be necessary. I mean, the Great Basin, almost anything you want is there. You can make lye. You've got salmoniac inside of the volcanic rims, as I mentioned. They were active at the time they were here. So, you know, the chemistry was there. They marked it, and the symbols are there. If you get out in the Great Basin, if you learn alchemy, and you'll see a fluid form of alchemy, not the stiff stuff we get in Europe where we have stiff square lines, and, you know, their alchemy is very linear. This stuff was like, very much a lot like their language. If you look at the writing, Sanskrit. It's written in a cursive kind of a letter, and these alchemical symbols are sometimes cursive. I didn't have the time to go into this, but we literally have the equation for breaking out from the dolomite, making soma. It's right on the rocks at one of these sites. It's literally there. It tells you how to take the salt, how to digest it, to worry about the lead. They talk about using their heat. Every part of that equation is right on the rocks in alchemical lingo. So these people were not only doing it, they were letting people know that came in that were following their lead later on, other alchemists, other esoterics, how to use it. They warned about arsenic. They warned you about lead. I gave you one example. They let us know how to do it, where to do it, and when to do it. Once you read these rocks, it's all there. It's nothing primitive about it. Now, later Indians did butcher these. They came into their own symbols. I've got plenty of examples of later alchemical symbolism by people who took it in their own direction. Much like languages change, this is hermetic drift in symbols. And you will see the localized effects. Black rock in Utah. These are anthropomorphic symbols done with alchemy. In Hawaii, again, anthropomorphic symbols. So in different areas, different periods, they would change these symbols. They would make them their own. But they're always based in alchemy. And astrology. Mm-hmm.
Dorian, can your products be purchased online? And if so, can you give out your contact information again, please?
Yeah, certainly. We'll be up by the end of the week, probably. The information, so you can order it from us. Just send us an email. And there's a price list on there, so you can break it down. You can see what's there. We're going to have all the images up shortly. The address is spagyricarts.com. That's SPAGYRIC. It's an alchemical term for plant alchemy, coined probably by Paracelsus, I think. But again, spagyric arts, and arts is plural. If you mistype it, you'd probably get us anyway. We have a link from that. But spagyricarts.com. And you can also shoot us information at info at Spagyric Arts. You can ask some questions. These products range. They're very inexpensive. These are a fully ounce bottle, which is a teaspoon or teaspoon and a half for the Soma Amrita. It is a daily dose, so you'll get about 33 out of a bottle, and it runs $69. So it's not expensive. It's a couple bucks a day. The Zextine, I sell it cheaper than anyone I know of. It's $25 for an 8-ounce bottle, about 30 most places. And the dolomite is also a little expensive for dolomite, but it's a very unique dolomite. We have to price it because we have to do a small-scale operation here. But the dolomite's price, we can have a 5-pound, if you want to do it for a year, there's a 5-pound container. 1 pound, I forget even how we price it, but it's pretty cheap. I mean, it's not an expensive product. And you can make your own elixir from it. I mean, this is the real stuff we use, and it's very clean. We mill it, and we take as much of the iron filings out as we can get with magnets. It's clean as we can get it, and it's wonderful for making elixir if you want to do it yourself. And a lot of people, I think, on this forum would love to try that. Yeah,
and
we also.
So you can also just take this dolomite. Mix that with water and take it as a supplement. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, in fact, we love to put it into orange juice. If you put it into a citric acid product like orange juice, my wife loves grapefruit juice. What you'll get is it'll start breaking down the calcium. It's nice to divide up your metals. If you're going to take calcium and take it quickly, that'll be leaving your system. But the dolomite takes longer to process. The magnesium carbonate won't break down even stomach acid very quickly. Not very efficiently, probably 25-30% at most gets in your system in about 12 hours in the small colon. So as you're doing the dolomite, you're getting this nice calcium that gives you enough calcium without having to drink fatty products or milk. You can get it right out of the dolomite the way nature itself does, the way the ocean got it. And you can let the magnesium process out. And it does have the quintessentia in it. And we believe it was marked so that we would indicate that it has copper, silver, and some rhodium. But probably not iridium and gold because it's not in an area for that. The area is miles away where you start seeing silicates. So it's probably going to be these two or three of the five that I mentioned. And if you look at those in a crystallogic chart, if you look at the matrix, the structure of these things, these are face-centered cubics. This is a huge breakthrough. If you listen to what I just told you again, face-centered cubics, look at what John Maluski's been doing with the gases, with these inert gases. They're also face-centered cubics. You'll find that this is a key. And so we kind of...
Listen, we got to wind this up.
Okay.
You'll be speaking about that at the conference, by the way.
Who will?
John Maluski.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mentioned the face-centered cubics to him, so we've talked a bit, so maybe he's picked up on that, too. But it's something, a discovery I made several years ago.
We'll do this again soon.
Yeah, that'd be great, sir. I'd love to do
it. Good. This has been really, really wonderful. I really, really appreciate you finally getting on here. I do have the link to Spagyric Bagheera Art, and I will send it out to all of the people who are on the benefactors list. I will also send out a link to the all of the images. Some of the images in the future, we want to change names so that there's no spaces in them because that messes things up a bit. But,
yeah, I'll go send those back to you. I'll get it cleaned up.
We'll work on that. And thank you very, very much, Dorian, for your time and all of the effort you put into this. This has just absolutely been fantastic.
A little download for the brain. You're very welcome. I hope that it helps people in this community to recognize that there was an, you know, we've kind of went forward with Dave Hudson into modern science. Now let's look backwards and see who really knew how to do this, you know, 25,000 years ago. They might have a little wisdom for us, you know.
There you go.
Well, thanks, Barry.